It won't be a stylish marriage. I can't afford a carriage. But you'll look sweet upon the seat of a bicycle built for two.
Hobby horse, velocipede, poor man's horse, high wheel, bone shaker, penny farthing, safety, iron grasshopper, giraffe, steed of steel on which you straddle, paddle, and skedaddle. What am I talking about? All of these are early names for what became known as the bicycle. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. Joshua Town initiated the first recorded velocipede ride in Wisconsin in the winter of 1869 in Milwaukee, causing quite a sensation. How did Wisconsin respond to cycling trends in Europe and the East Coast? What caused velocipede mania, followed by its decline? How did biking become an elitist activity dominated by wealthy white men? Joining me to explore the colorful and surprisingly political history of bicycling in Wisconsin are Jesse Gant and Nicholas Hoffman, co-authors of Wheel Fever, How Wisconsin Became a Great Bicycling State, an illustrated book published by the Wisconsin State Historical Society in 2013. Jesse Gant is a UW-Madison doctoral candidate in history and a public humanities fellow with the Wisconsin Humanities Council, and Nicholas Hoffman is chief curator at the History Museum at the Castle in Appleton. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
This is a fascinating book. I'm curious what kind of led you to consider writing a book about the history of the bicycle in Wisconsin.
We were graduate students at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee beginning 2004, maybe 2005, in the same public history seminar with Jasmine Allender over there. And that got us thinking about writing for a broader audience, taking on a topic that would have broad appeal. When I moved to Madison later on to begin graduate training, I was working for the Wisconsin Historical Society Press and just noticed a preponderance of great primary sources around bicycling, photographs, newspapers, magazines, and different kinds of publications. And Nick and I, being friends, had a number of conversations about ways of turning that material into a book.
Yeah, we both had encountered conversations about bicycles doing not necessarily unrelated research projects, but either coming across bicycle parades with the Grand Army of the Republic or glass workers biking to the workplace in Milwaukee. There were definitely some threads in our own research that suggested that there was a really important story to tell in Wisconsin. Why was the bicycle an important part of these organizations and workers?
Well, and I was surprised to see quotations scattered throughout your book from famous people that I didn't know kind of weighed in on the bicycle issue, like Susan B. Anthony, who said, "Let me tell you what I think of bicycling. I think it has done more to emancipate women than anything else in the world." You know, that was an eye-opener for me because when I think of Susan B. Anthony, I think of, you know, the suffragette movement and different things like that, but I don't think of the bicycle. So lots more to it.
Yeah, there's a transition that's kind of going on during this time period where a lot of people, if they wanted to get from point A to point B, you have the railroad, you have boat transportation, and you have horses, which can be unreliable. They take a lot of time to prepare to even take an excursion through the city or to visit friends in a nearby town. And they're expensive. If you live in a city, you might have to have your horse stay at a livery stable. And so horse transportation is pretty elite during this time period. It's something that a lot of people couldn't find to be very accessible. And so the bicycle, when it starts to emerge in Wisconsin, it holds that possibility as, well, it's referred to often as the poor man's horse, a new type of transportation that was accessible to a larger amount of people.
Well, let's take it back before we get it to Wisconsin. Let's take the bicycle, velocipede, whatever the early names are going to be, back to where you see the first invention, the first use of something that you would see as a forerunner of the bike.
I think that discussion probably begins around 1817 in Germany. There's a German arborist actually named Carl von Dreiss who devises a very simple machine. It's basically two wheels attached by a single wooden pole or frame. It's called a hobby horse, and he uses it to survey his grounds as an arborist and survey the trees and look at the property that he's using. It's basically a work tool.
This may be a silly question, but mm-hmm. it almost seems to me that you would find, given the fact that carriages go back so much farther, mm-hmm. why would it take till 1817?
That's right.
It seems as if you'd find yeah. an ancient Greek bicycle.
and there are debates about, Da Vinci has drawings, I guess, in his collection that all the components for the modern bicycle are essentially there. It's kind of a puzzle as to why until the 19th century these things were not combined.
Yeah. There's a lot of people throughout history who are thinking about human power transportation. This is really one of the more successful models that has a little bit of staying power. The machine itself, the hobby horse, is really awkward to operate. As Jesse had mentioned, is basically a saddle between two wheels, and the rider would straddle that and basically walk in place and propel themselves forward.
And how would you stop?
Well, just by using your feet, it's almost
putting your foot to the ground.
It's like the Flintstones almost. it's literally foot powered. And it does have some staying power in Europe. Not something that a lot of people are riding, but there's some ideas that it could be used in the military. It does make its way into New England and as far west as possibly Cincinnati. So it is a machine that has a very brief period. I don't even know if we can really call it a popular machine, but people are thinking about that a little bit further. Is a machine that could become more of a reality.
Some of my other research finds Jessie Benton Fremont, the wife of presidential candidate John Fremont in 1856, describing her children riding a hobby horse in the basement of their house.
Oh, okay.
So it also becomes quickly a toy for children.
Yeah.
Eventually.
Were there also sort of tricycles simultaneously?
Absolutely. And there's all sorts of different kinds of conveyances that are kind of lurking around in the 1840s and 50s before that velocipede becomes much more popular in the 1860s.
Well, let's talk about the velocipede.
Yeah.
That's not necessarily a household word anymore.
Yeah.
But it turned into a huge craze, including in Wisconsin. So back that up to where do you find the first velocipede and why is it called that?
Yeah. In Europe, essentially, the hobby horse has a little more staying power than in the United States. And inventors and tinkerers keep working on that very simple design. And they end up putting pedals on the front hub of the front wheel, which now gives you a little more power to move forward. And so it's emerging about the time of our American Civil War in Europe. And it makes its way to the United States right after the Civil War. We see velocipedes starting to emerge on the East Coast. And in Wisconsin, they are paying attention to that. Occasionally in our local newspapers, whether it's a large city like Milwaukee or a smaller community at that time like Appleton, people are paying attention to this new technology as it's starting to creep its way across the Midwest. And it finally makes its way here in January of 1869. In the dead of winter, a man by the name of Joshua Town was spotted riding a velocipede in downtown Milwaukee. And it's really treated as a major technological change for the state. It's considered, for Milwaukeeans, one piece of evidence that the city was growing into a new modern city because the velocipede had arrived.
And what was it made out of?
So they emerge out of carriage and blacksmith shops, predictably, in Paris. They're made out of wood and iron. There are no rubber tires. There's no pneumatic tube yet in the machines, and they quickly gain a sort of infamous moniker as a bone shaker. and so the very, very rough, as you can predict, a iron and wooden machine powered by a pedal on the front wheel that's bigger than the back wheel, sometimes incorporating a leather saddle, but often just a very rough, rickety, primitive sort of tool.
And when Joshua Town sat on this thing and rode through Milwaukee, other than sort of creating a spectacle and getting attention, was he seeing it as a leisure activity, as a fun kind of the way, somebody might go bungee jumping, or was it seen as for fun?
Well, there's cartoons that appear in publications like Harper's Weekly at the same time frame. We get a little bit of a glimpse to what people were thinking about the velocipede. And those cartoons do illustrate that there are very practical applications for this new machine, whether it's delivery. Joshua Towne worked for the American Express Company, so that's could suggest why he was interested in the Velocipede. There's military applications, people delivering groceries. And it's really interesting in Wisconsin how quickly it moves throughout the state, too. Joshua Towne, again, is spotted in January 1869. By the end of that month, we see the Velocipede appearing in cities like Eau Claire, Oshkosh, Appleton, and even small communities like Fox Lake. It spread really like wildfire throughout the state of Wisconsin.
Nick identifies kind of how the use of the Velocipede spreads pretty quickly in the spring of 1869. But initially, there is a lot of rhetoric around the Velocipede as a poor man's horse. And a lot of the young people, especially in Paris, who are storming around the city and riding the boulevards and stuff, are celebrating working man's liberation through the Velocipede.
In terms of it being something that someone who could not afford a horse and carriage could afford this Velocipede?
They're still pretty expensive in Wisconsin. There are individuals who are purchasing, I mean, can't really necessarily call them manufacturers yet of this machine, but there's folks like Thomas Pickering on the East Coast who's making several hundred Velocipedes. But in Wisconsin, we have companies like Crawford Brothers Carriage Company in Oshkosh who are making a very small number of these. There's a man named Dr. Hubbard who lived in Ripon who's making, at least their newspapers reporting, two Velocipedes. So they are pretty exclusive when they come out and expensive. They're anywhere from $125 to $175, which at that time pushes it a little bit beyond the working class.
Yeah, that would be a lot of money in yeah. today's terms. You mentioned in your book, Will Fever, about the problem of roads, that you have these Velocipedes, but not good roads to, and sort of the debate over, you know, do they go on a sidewalk and how do you deal with the dusty, dirty, bumpy roads? At the time that Joshua Towne rides through Milwaukee in 1869 and it starts to spread, what was the situation like in terms of the roads?
Well, in Wisconsin, it's very primitive. We're just coming out of the Civil War. There are a few military roads that have crisscrossed the state going back to antebellum times and early military installations up through the Mississippi Valley. But improved roads are very rare. Railroads have just begun sort of making their way into the state of Wisconsin. So in a lot of conditions, a lot of places outside of Milwaukee and a lot of rural places throughout the state, you're looking at very dirty, primitive rural roads with crumbling bridges. And you see all sorts of frontier accounts describing these scenes at this period.
Yeah, so It's tough because these machines are called bone shakers for a reason. They're pretty tough to operate. They are without treads, so riding in the winter when they arrive, that's a challenge. And so where do you ride a Velocipede becomes a pretty important conversation right away. In a lot of cities throughout Wisconsin, we didn't really have, even within our downtowns, very nice roads. So Velocipede riders take to nicer, smoother wooden plank sidewalks. They take it a little bit further than that and try and move the sport indoors. And they take their cue from Paris, where there are large gymnasiums where a lot of Velocipede riding was happening inside these enormous buildings. But we really didn't have that in Wisconsin. So a lot of our Masonic lodges, opera halls throughout the state on our main streets, the second floor of a lot of these commercial buildings where those were located, become indoor Velocipede rinks. And it's tough. Imagine riding a bicycle as a kid when you first learned from a very experienced rider. These individuals were learning to ride in a very small space by individuals who maybe themselves had only mastered the Velocipede a week or two ago.
Well, that brings up the issue of injuries. In these early days of Velocipedes in Wisconsin, did you have a lot of, what were they called, headbangers? I mean, did you have a lot of accidents?
You did, and they sort of courted this culture as well. Velocipede rinks were all about sort of cultivating a more bravado and daredevilish sort of early culture around the sport, and to the point where we found one account from a city in Illinois, Jacksonville, Illinois, where they put a ramp next to the window and actually launched themselves.
Yeah.
Velocipede riders would ride down the ramp and then launch themselves to the neighboring building across the alley.
Kind of the Evel Knievel.
Yeah, yeah. So very quickly, the Velocipede gives mind to all these devilish ideas.
What about circuses? Do they catch on pretty quickly?
There is an air of circus. Edith Schuller, a young woman from Chicago and kind of a mysterious figure. We don't know a lot about her. would charge audiences 25 cents for an appearance. And one of her most famous velocipede tricks was standing on the saddle of a velocipede and then circling the velocipede rink. And this apparently drove Milwaukee audiences crazy in the spring of 1869. Just hundreds of people turning out to see this.
Velocipede rinks really struggled because the machines were expensive. There wasn't a large supply of them, even for people who wanted to purchase them. And so as these rinks opened for people to ride, they kind of try and figure out where they're heading with this new activity. They start charging admission for people to come and watch accidents or performers. They bring in performers to try and draw more attention to the velocipede. It really starts to struggle. And a lot of those accidents, as people are learning to ride, start being drawn out in the newspapers. Yep. There's a lot of questions of this new machine. And by the summer, we actually start to see cities in Janesville, Milwaukee, Appleton banning velocipede riders in their downtown commercial districts.
And why did the velocipede fail then? I mean, it was catching on in other parts of the world. Mm-hmm. What sort of got in its way?
I think in Wisconsin, at least, a large part of the story is it's just terribly impractical for any sort of application beyond the rinks. And
because of the roads?
Or? Because of the roads and because of the machine itself just being so primitive that it, you know, it held some promise as an entertainment tool, but not a very practical or utilitarian one.
And when you say primitive, what did it not have that it needed?
Well, the velocipede craze pretty much comes to an end by the summer of 1869. By the middle 1870s, new design innovations initiated primarily in England will incorporate rubber tires, improved spokes, and better saddle technology, which leads to this next phase in the sort of, not to make it a determinist story about technological development, but these improvements do draw new recruits to the sport and signal for the first time that this machine might have a practical usage.
As soon as the velocipede starts to show some weaknesses, newspapers really jump on that. They tell stories of horrific crashes, women like Edith Schuler riding the velocipede, frightened conservatives in a lot of cities. And so there's a lot of animosity with conservatives in Wisconsin who are really looking for reasons to discredit this new technology.
We'll talk more about women on the bicycle and some of the new technologies that are coming along to replace the velocipede when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. Fats Domino song about the bicycle. I'm Emily Auerbach, and I am back with my two guests, Jesse Gant and Nicholas Hoffman, co-authors of Wheel Fever, How Wisconsin Became a Great Bicycling State. But one of the things that you bring up in your book is that not everybody got to ride on a bike. Not everyone was able to join the bicycling clubs that started to form. There were sort of very concerted efforts to keep it only a sport for sort of well-to-do white men. Mm. Let's start with the whole question of women. If you look at the fashions from the late 1800s, let's say you look at from 1869 when we first had the velocipede ride in Milwaukee, the women are wearing these long dresses that look like you could barely move. So right off the bat, there's going to be a problem for women wanting to ride a bike. Can you tell us about some of the early women who did want to try? What kind of started to change as a result of that?
I think this goes right back to those to the Paris scene in 1869 when a lot of the young women are taking laps around the city and in the parks, aligning the sport from the very start with a sort of bourgeois sensibility and even a radical sensibility among the sort of emerging women's rights discourses at this time. And it generates a lot of animosity throughout England, throughout Europe, throughout the United States. That we see, there was a newspaper account that we found in an Appleton newspaper that sort of portrayed this fantasy world where a young fellow named Augustus L. Fell so in love with the velocipede that he ruined his marriage. And the lines go, "Remember the fate our AL has just met. Let this be your warning creed. Stay at home with your wife the rest of your life and avoid the velocipede."
So don't ruin your marriage.
Yeah.
And most of all, don't let your wife on that bike, because it's at a time where you have the Victorian fashions and covering your body. It's difficult to ride in that way.
Yeah. And the machines themselves with that fashion in mind are really designed to be prohibitive of women then participating in the sport. If they're required to wear all that fashion and these long skirts and you're riding on a machine that very easily would get those skirts caught in the spokes, preparing you for an accident, it really limited access to the sport.
Well, you mentioned Edith Schuller, I think it was, who was charging to have people see her ride a velocipede. Well, how did she do that then? Did she sort of start wearing different kinds of fashions?
Yeah, you start to see, for someone like herself, you see it occasionally in Paris, bloomers being worn underneath the skirts so you can access the pedals a little bit easier. She's a professional cyclist at that point. I mean, she isn't literally a professional cyclist as we would think later in the 1890s with racers, but she's a highly, highly skilled cyclist. And so she's able to accommodate her skirt and is used to riding with that. It's her profession after all. So,
well, I know sometimes the early women riders were called all kinds of insulting names like hyena and petticoats and, you know, blue stockings and so on. I mean, I'm assuming that these early women who tried to ride a bike would be dismissed as, I think at one point you said somebody called them witches astride
broomsticks.
So when Susan B. Anthony called the bicycle something that helped to emancipate women more than anything else, what was she referring to then?
There's some technological changes that had happened with the bicycle. By that time, we had moved from the high wheel phase. Even though there were machines like side saddle high wheels that accommodated skirts, there were large tricycles that were expensive. And so we don't see those that often in Wisconsin that women could ride. It's really with the invention of the safety bicycle and the drop bar frame safety that is designed to accommodate skirts hanging down, as well as netting that would be put across the rear wheels and to cover up the chains. Those are mass produced by the thousands and thousands. And in the 1890s, once that bicycle is available, one of the key contributions to Wisconsin having a bicycle boom is women really had access to the sport in the sense that they could purchase these machines in large numbers. It's women who are driving a large portion of the bicycle boom by the 1890s.
So let's take it back. You've mentioned a couple different kinds of bikes there, the high wheel and the safety and so on. The high wheel, when I see pictures of it with this giant, you know, front wheel and then this tiny little other wheel.
Yeah.
So I assume it's called high wheel because one of them is so high up. Why did they design it that way? Yeah. It looks like an accident waiting to happen.
Yeah, I think historians of science would have a lot more to say about this than we would. But the high wheel doesn't emerge initially as an intentionally exclusive technology. It isn't the idea that a gender exclusion is implicit to the design or to the thinking behind the technology. It's more that that high wheel allows a greater rate of speed and does promote some stability. I mean, I think there's a tendency to kind of dismiss the high wheel as this impractical abomination, technological Frankenstein. But quite In reality, they're quite amazing machines. We've seen them, Nick and I, up close, and people riding them throughout the summer and at some of our events. Very stable, actually.
Yeah.
They can go hundreds of miles in a single day. We've seen people ride them around the world on occasion.
They're remarkably fast. I mean, it's hard to go uphill because you don't have gearing. But when you're on a straightaway with an enormous wheel like that, one rotation, you're going 160 inches. It's incredibly fast.
How high off the ground would you be if you were sitting on one of the big highways?
It all depends. You have to be able to reach the pedal. And so they would measure your inseam and... Your inseam would basically be the length from sitting on the seat down to the pedal. So double that, and you're really remarkably high. And the pedals are fixed right to the hub. So when you're going downhill with a big wheel like that, you reach amazing speeds. And we've watched high wheel riders today master that. They take their legs and kick them over the front handlebars and just kind of go with the speed down the hill. There is a very simple braking system on high wheels, but it's just much easier and safer just to kind of go with it.
You mentioned in your book, too, that it got people off the dusty, dirty roads.
Yeah.
Because they're not, you know, as close to all that mud and dust.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so kind of tie it back to this 1870s, 1880s moment when this technology is kind of developing and being perfected. Part of the problem that the cyclists riding these machines then face is, well, how do we gain acceptance in the streets, and how do we demonstrate our belonging in the streets? And it's sort of an outgrowth of the technology itself, but it's also part of this politics of demonstrating a sort of militant sensibility that I think it becomes aligned with the manly culture.
Yeah.
Where they basically adopt military uniforms and pith helmets, and they bring out the bugles and the songs and the banners, and they ride in military formation around the cities to the effect of excluding women, of course. Mm-hmm. But it does sort of align the culture initially in this elite way.
Yeah, they had to be incredibly intimidating to come across. In Milwaukee, we've seen descriptions of 50 to 60 riders at night, all carrying Chinese lanterns. Like Jesse described, they're wearing uniforms. They have bugle calls to sound out different formations and to assemble and dismiss. It literally copies a lot of military organizations. Their bugle calls come right from the United States Army. They're copying their calls for use on the streets. It had to be quite the sight to see.
And are they riding as part of a club? We haven't talked about that exactly, but can you talk? And it seems that this big one, the League of American Wheelmen, gets going, what, in 1880? Or?
Yep. That's an organization formed largely by Massachusetts riders, but I think it's formally organized in Rhode Island in 1880. It becomes a national cycling advocacy organization in the 1880s and 1890s. And state chapters like the state of Wisconsin would basically form organizations at a local level and then attach themselves to the League of American Women. So they had a local organization, but then it was represented by the national organization. And the League was a very important organization. I can't overstate the significance of the League of American Women to this period, because not only are they organizing the rides and the sort of the experience of bicycling, but they're organizing the culture to an effect. And so you have League of American Women clubhouses in a lot of the cities and towns, where the League has publications that you can read in the libraries. You can check out books related to cycling in a lot of the parlors. You have a social venue. They exclude women from these spaces, and so it becomes another sort of fraternal space. Mm-hmm. It's just a really key development.
Yeah, their whole structure, they're copying other organizations like the Masons, the Knights of Pythias. Mm-hmm. So they have that really exclusive structure built into their organization right from the start. And there's some interest, too. As bicycling in the early 1880s is just starting to get its footing, some of the key people involved with starting the League of American Wheelmen are also manufacturers. So they know if they can create this brotherhood of the wheel, as they call it, that'll create more cyclists and more sales.
So there's this economic motive there. Mm-hmm. Well, the men that would be part of this League of American Wheelmen, which has that acronym LAW Law, but anyway, so the men that would be in that group as opposed to in the Masons or something else, were there certain characteristics, kind of personality types, and were they seeing it as as a whimsical plaything, or as something that they were actually using to get from place to place?
I think there's a little bit of all that happening, and they do come from elite families. If we look at the Milwaukee Wheelmen, for instance, a lot of them are the sons of really successful manufacturers in Milwaukee. Some of the key figures we look at in our book would be Terry and Henry Andre. Their father was Julius Andre, who had a very successful firm in Milwaukee. So in some ways, these are young bored men looking for something new to do. They're really excited by the manliness of riding a high wheel. Terry Andre, for instance, is really excited about the opportunity to race. He was a very successful high wheel racer. So, yeah, there's a lot of different things that are drawing people to the sport.
Stephen Babcock, right?
Yes.
Has an LAW card in his collections.
So. Yeah, the inventor of the Babcock tester. And ice cream, of course. Yeah, well, not the inventor of ice cream, but everyone knows Babcock ice cream.
How did they justify keeping women out? What were some of the arguments that were used?
Well, importantly, women are not okay with this decision, and they're demanding access to the sport from the very start. And they've already demonstrated that with the Velocipede era, and they're looking at the high wheels rise, and they're saying, we too want to enjoy the freedom of mobility that the bicycle promotes. And they're even couching it initially in some ways around the health benefits of cycling. And so they actually do form their own organizations, and they will sort of break off and form their own women's clubs and women's organizations. I don't believe that there is a national women's organization to sort of pair with the League of American Women, but there are local organizations that gain a lot of membership through women-specific publications and newspapers and organizations at the time.
We see a lot of women's clubs forming through the state's normal schools. Lawrence University had the SB Cycling Club. So we see that as being a pretty common avenue for young women to participate in the sport. And there were women who did join the League of American Wheelmen, but they were relegated typically to a ladies' department within the club and were responsible for making sure meals were ready for the upcoming fundraisers and those type of activities.
You also mentioned in your book that African Americans and people from other races other than whites were excluded as well from the League of American Wheelmen. Can you talk about that a bit?
Some reviewers have not been happy with our focus on race in the book, which I think is really unfortunate. Wisconsin, throughout the 19th century, has a very small African-American population, and that's very clear. However, there are black riders in the state, and unfortunately, the record is just not there to document a lot of their experiences. But we have evidence from all across the Midwest, all across the country. A great example in Boston of black riding clubs, African American clubs in Chicago, and certainly examples in our own book of figures we ultimately were not able to identify, stories we weren't able to tell, but a presence nonetheless of African American riders at the Milwaukee to Waukesha road meet. And so we know that they existed. Race comes into the Wheelmen in a lot of different ways, and it's an important story in the bicycling boom because it's just very clear that the Wheelmen are not friendly to non-white riders. I mean, they're hosting minstrel shows at their clubhouses. Racist sort of parodies and caricatures are common in the lithographs and visual culture of the period. And they actually ban African-American riders most conclusively at the 1894 convention in Louisville.
Why would reviewers not be happy with that part of your book? It seems to me a very important story.
Yeah, it's strange.
Yeah, very, very limited responses.
But it, just it one a couple reviews, but yeah, it's been strange.
Yeah, and when we look at cycling today, as good historians, we want to explain conversations that are happening in the present. And so the Wisconsin Bicycle Federation, for instance, is working towards equity. That's one of their big agendas for this year, is to reach the sport out and draw in more women and people of color to participate. And so this book, we hope, sheds a little bit on that long story within cycling.
There are examples of Chinese riders, I think even a Japanese rider spotted in Green Bay at one point. Ho-Chunk riders are in the book. And it kind of ties back to this larger tension among white society at the time about the mobility of these groups and the potential, these sort of racist fantasies that unaccompanied people of color will be traveling into areas that they're not welcome. And so it does give rise to a lot of these unfortunate caricatures.
After we move past the high wheel, was the next big phase the safety?
Yeah. If you kind of chart the familiar technological story, the safety is the next major step.
And was it called the safety partly as a sort of propaganda campaign? So you think it was safe, or was it actually?
It's pretty
It's so safe that it's still what we're riding, basically. It's still basically the same machine as the modern bicycle.
It's a much shorter fall to the ground than on the high wheel. And our book does occasionally mention some terrible high wheel accidents and safety accidents. But the safety bicycle is really questioned when it rides. The men who were in the wheelman clubs considered and actually quite commonly would say that real men rode high wheels. And this new bicycle that was emerging, the safety bicycle, they feminized it. They called it the bicyclette. And in 1887, there's a really important race in Wisconsin. A man by the name of Parker Surcombe, who was a mildly successful high wheel racer, was going to race a safety bicycle against Terry Andre, who is one of the top amateur high wheel racers in Wisconsin and Illinois. And on a normal race day, the two would very rarely be neck and neck. And so some media decided to cover the event. And in the race, Parker Surcombe almost beats Terry Andre. So even though Terry Andre wins on the high wheel, Parker on his safety is actually considered the victor as far as the newspaper was concerned, because his race was much more effortless because of the chains and gearing. And he came pretty close to beating Terry Andre. So from that period forward, that not necessarily just because of that race, but this new technology really starts to creep into Wisconsin. And by the early 1890s, it's really reaching that period of the bicycle boom. Bicycle madness has reached the streets of Wisconsin.
I forgot to ask you about the early races between bicycles and horses, too, when they were getting going. But those struck me as that they would be fun to watch. But
One of the premier showcases for the high wheel technology was to race a high wheel against a horse. And one of the great examples I remember from the book is Nellie Tallman down in Janesville taking her children off to the Rock County Fairgrounds and watching the Ohio Maid, which is the name of the horse, and this high wheel machine race across the grounds. Inevitably, the horse would win, but the bicycle would do so well that was kind of the idea, is that it would prove itself to be competitive and kind of, you know, people's minds would explode watching this happen. And so Nellie's kids actually within a few days went out and bought their own bicycles. So it's also kind of a clever marketing ploy, too.
Yeah.
Well, and we think of bicycles as something now that we introduce to children. At what point do you start seeing it as quite common with these safeties for children to have them?
Well, I mean, the last lingering descriptions that we see of even a velocipede in 1869, by the end of that summer, in like the Milwaukee Sentinel, the last remnants are descriptions of young kids. If I recall correctly, it was in Waupun riding velocipedes throughout the city. So there's a connection that is there, I think, really from the start. Unfortunately, after the bicycle boom ends in 1900, not to get too far ahead of ourselves, the bicycle becomes relegated after the automobile makes its presence known. The bicycle, for a long time, becomes almost a child's toy. It's viewed that way as something that kids do. And it isn't really until about the 1970s where we start to break out of that shadow again.
And we'll talk about the 20th century and bicycles when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air.
Forget to mention the bicycle is a good invention. Make it up, making you my business. A funny buttercup, gotta live a forgiveness. Happy days, but sad facing. Heaven knows I'm on the case. So how could I forget to mention the bicycle?
That's from Bicycle Song by the Red Hot Chili Peppers, taking us into the 20th century with our topic, bicycling in Wisconsin. I'm Emily Auerbach, and my two guests are Jesse Gant and Nicholas Hoffman, who are the co-authors of Wheel Fever, a book about bicycling in Wisconsin, and also are contributors to a touring statewide exhibit called Shifting Gears, A Cyclical History of the Badger State. I wanted to start with a quote that I love in your book from author Stephen Crane. We know him as the author of The Red Badge of Courage. But this is a piece that he wrote in the New York Sun in July 1896. And he's describing New York's bicycling scene. He writes, "On fine days, bicyclists appear in thousands. All mankind is a wheel, apparently, and a person on nothing but legs feels like a strange animal. A mighty army of wheels streams from the brick wilderness below Central Park and speeds over the asphalt. In the cool of the evening, it returns with the swaying and flashing of myriad lamps. The bicycle crowd has completely subjugated the street. The glittering wheels dominate it from end to end. The cafes and dining rooms of the apartment hotels are occupied mainly by people in bicycle clothes. Even the billboards have surrendered. They advertise wheels and lamps and tires and patent saddles with all the flaming vehemence of circus art. Down at the circle, there stands the patient Columbus. The stores are crowded with bicycle goods. There are innumerable repair shops. Everything is bicycle." So tell us about that. Is at 1896 in New York, everything is bicycle. What about 1896 in Wisconsin? Are we is everything bicycle here too?
Well, by 1895, the League of American Women has proclaimed the state of Wisconsin the leading division of the West, which means in the 19th century imagination, everything basically northwest of the Ohio River. That includes quite a few major cities by that point: Chicago, Detroit, Toledo, Cleveland, even the West Coast. So Wisconsin has emerged as a top cycling destination. And we included the quote in the book because it so nicely captured what the scene looked like in parts of Wisconsin during the last half of the 1890s.
Yeah. So each summer, the Wisconsin Division of the League of American Wheelmen would host their annual state meet, which is partially a conference to talk about their agenda for the next year. But they would also bring in amateur and professional cyclists for races. But they would try and bring as many cyclists from the state together. So we get cities like Oshkosh and Appleton that are described as being overwhelmed with whole trains just full of cyclists descending on the city. So that Central Park scene with the park clogged with cyclists is very real, especially during those state meets. But even in Milwaukee, there's complaints by Milwaukee's trolley operators that there are too many people riding bicycles. They're not paying trolley fares to get from point A to point B. We see photographs of factories in Wausau that have bicycles parked outside them. People were using the bicycle not just for sport and recreation at this point. They were using it just to get about their daily business.
How dare they?
Yeah.
And tell us about what happens then as the automobile starts to emerge.
Yeah, and so this is where the downfall begins. The automobile pretty quickly establishes itself as a viable moneymaker and a viable answer to this problem of how to get from here to there in a fairly cheap and practical way. In a time when there really isn't a lot of fidelity necessarily to the bicycle, more than there is just a sort of practical question of how do I get around easily, the automobile just becomes much more attractive and lucrative. And mm-hmm. So a lot of the industry ties that are established in the bicycling community, Henry Ford is a bike mechanic in Detroit before he's the Auto King. Chevrolet, a lot of these names are in the bicycling community, the Wright brothers, aviation leaders, and they just kind of go into other facets of the industry by the early 20th century.
It's a frustrating thing as cyclists today. We see cycling essentially being removed entirely from the state budget and road building growing in the state budget. And if we trace the origins of this road building movement all the way back to its beginnings, and then especially when cyclists start to pick it up in the 1890s, it's the League of American Wheelmen that are leading the good roads movement during this period. They're creating our modern automobile culture. Bicycle tourism in Wisconsin was very popular, and the roads were in poor condition. So we see leaders like Otto Dorner of Milwaukee, a socialist who's working with William Dempster Hoard together, a conservative rural farmer, coming together to create a lobby to improve Wisconsin's rural roads. So once the automobile comes, it is part of that bicycle movement. The League of American Wheelmen become an advocacy group for automobiles and roads.
So in a way, the car industry could build on the infrastructure that was already there and the movement to try to spread that.
There's a lot more to say about that. I mean, the League, a major part of the League's advocacy is to promote cheaper rates on rail networks for bicyclists. So they're integrating various kinds of infrastructure systems. They're providing special rates at hotels for league affiliated riders, and they're giving you they're organizing to promote cheaper meals in restaurants even. So you begin to see this sort of incorporation of maybe a kind of early fast food move.
Yeah, even major highways like the Lincoln Highway, which cuts through a lot of the Midwest. Their structure of creating tour booklets for finding discounts at hotels, restaurants, that's all copying what cyclists were doing in the 1890s. But yeah, they essentially, automobiles move into this big infrastructure that cycling had created.
You mentioned in the conclusion to your book that Europe seems to continue its bicycling traditions to a greater extent than we do here, that with the car taking over, it just, you don't see as many bicycles continuing into the 20th, 21st century. Why is that?
That's a complicated story, and I don't know that we can answer it fully, but it does seem to be the case that in Europe there's a deeper affinity for bicycling, and they sort of, especially the egalitarian aspect of cycling, where Americans always treated it as a recreational sort of pursuit, something to do with your spare time. Europeans, by virtue of maybe denser cities and closer proximity, a more urban sort of lifestyle, just found the bicycle more conducive to their everyday journeys, whereas Americans have all this space to contend with.
Yeah,
I mean, not to get too Frederick Jackson Turner in 1893, but like I think that does matter quite a bit to American imagination of transportation at this period.
Yeah, our 20th century cities are designed entirely around the automobile, so they sprawl a lot and become spaces for automobiles, and city planners start to leave out the bicycle.
I think you say in your book that Wisconsin has one of the biggest per capita amounts of bike, I don't think big is the right word, but it has the most bike trails per capita just about of any state. Mm-hmm. So can you talk about that, why Wisconsin would end up with all these bike trails?
There are some origins to the 1890s, and it's much more successful in cities like Minneapolis. But in Wisconsin, we do see some early trail systems starting. There's something called a side path, which is a small space of improved basically a path that would be right alongside a road. And we see those popping up in the 1890s, mid-1890s, like 1895 in Appleton. They establish a side path connecting their fairgrounds to their downtown for cyclists. There's a really extensively developed cycle path from Chippewa Falls to the city of Eau Claire, connecting those two cities. But that really doesn't catch on in a big way in Wisconsin during that period. It's not until the 1960s when in 1965 the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources establishes the first rail-to-trail system in Wisconsin. And we've really embraced that as rail travel saw a decline. Wisconsin was very active at the municipal level and state level to convert those into recreational trails.
I would think also Wisconsin's record on environmental history, where you've got the Aldo Leopolds and the other pioneers of conservation, that they would, in the 20th century, start embracing the bicycle as an alternative to a polluting automobile.
Yeah, and I think that's definitely part of the story for the 1960s and 1970s. You have Gaylord Nelson, of course, doing nationwide, even global, sort of important work with Earth Day mobilization, and the oil crisis in the early 1970s really kind of kickstarts again new thinking in the bicycling community around environment.
And in the 1890s, Wisconsin was a really big center for bicycle manufacturing, especially in southeast Wisconsin. We had manufacturers like Julius Andre and Son, BB Manufacturing, making all wood bicycles. In smaller cities like Oregon, we had the Badger Bicycle Works. And we don't really see that return for a very long period in Wisconsin. It ends basically at the conclusion of the first bicycle boom. But by the 1970s, as we have rails to trails, the infrastructure is there. More people are starting to ride a bicycle for recreation and to get to work. Manufacturing returns to the state. We see Trek and things like Graber, who made bicycle racks, today is known as Ceres. They start to return to the state. And today, Wisconsin's known because of that as a leader in bicycle manufacturing and bicycle racks and on-street parking.
When you see large groups of motorcyclists descending on the Capitol and the sort of culture of motorcycle riding, do you see parallels between that and what you document in your book with the early days of the cycling clubs?
Well, they share a common origin. A lot of the motorcycle companies originated as bike companies, and basically the innovation there is to add an engine to what already exists to the safety frames. And you see is there one like that in the exhibit of an early experimentation with a motorized bicycle?
No, there is a 1917 Harley-Davidson bicycle.
Yeah, so Harley-Davidson has its foot in this sort of industry. But they are very different cultures, mm-hmm. and I'm not enough of a student of motorcycling to know exactly how that happened or how that developed.
That'll be your next book, Motorcycling in Wisconsin. So,
I think the ideas of freedom and mobility are omnipresent in the cycling community. I think of like Easy Rider
And there's a lot of shared awareness and a lot of opportunity that I think could even be developed further for campaigns just to look for people on the streets who are doing two-wheeled transportation. I think there's a lot of opportunities for safety.
You have a quote in your book. I think it's a complaint about people going too fast on the bicycle and not noticing what's around them. This is from The Pneumatic in 1893. The bicycle rider who scorches over the country intent on making the most miles in the shortest time or with keeping up with the heedless leader of his party misses more than half of the delight of his ride. What does he know of the country he rides through? Of the wildflower by the roadside, the blue sky over him, the fields around him, or the blue mountains in the distance. His eyes are glued to the road or path, and his mind is on his handlebars or his pedals or his hurrying companions. You know, certainly that brings in that the culture of bicycling is something where you're to sort of slow down the pace.
Yeah, when you compare those lines to the words that George Kennan, the eventual diplomat to the Soviet Union in 1938, what he would write about his tour through the state of Wisconsin, he said, quote, "It seemed to me that these beautiful highways were the most deserted places I had ever seen. In the course of a 100-mile journey, I was destined to encounter on the open road no single fellow cyclist." So that really captures powerfully, I think, in the span of just a couple decades, how quickly the sport fell apart. And that's a picture from 1938, right on the cusp of World War II.
I'm curious, as you did this project together, the kind of tracking the history of bicycling in Wisconsin, looking through documents and putting it together, what surprised you the most about what you found?
Boy, every turn was really exciting for us. I think speaking, I guess Jesse would probably agree with this, that the research was some of the most exciting parts because we were going into a lot of uncharted territory for state history. I remember one day at the Milwaukee Public Library where they still had – certainly the Milwaukee Sentinel is digitized, but we were going through the old card catalog system of handwritten notes indexing the Milwaukee Sentinel and discovering in that this great story about the Velocipede's first arrival in Wisconsin and how excited we were that we could, you know, suggest some of those origins to the state that had – up until this point, really been neglected in state history. Cycling so often is just or was considered a footnote in the state's history. And we hope after this project that if you're writing about the late 19th century in Wisconsin, it's hopefully hard to overlook cycling and just how important it was to the state. Every turn in our research, we found a lot of interesting stories to tell. And there are many, many more that could be pulled from this book, all sorts of biographies and other pieces of cycling in Wisconsin.
Yeah, I think for me it was just the richness and the depth of the story. I didn't realize how far back the sport went and how profoundly it sort of shaped the state's course in the late 19th century. And we just found such a great visual record to accompany the story as well. We were so happy with a lot of the photographs and cartoons and stuff that we found.
Great. Well, thanks to both of you for being my guests. It's been fascinating. My guests have been Jesse Gant and Nicholas Hoffman. Their book is called Wheel Fever, and it is about the history of bicycling in Wisconsin. I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.